This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. If you still think of Katie Sagal as the dolled-up housewife from the sitcom Married with Children, you'd be surprised to see her in her current FX series Sons of Anarchy, which is now in its fifth season. Sagal plays Gemma, the fierce matriarch of an outlaw motorcycle club. Gemma's willing to beat or threaten to kill anyone who threatens her family. Before we get to Terry's interview with Katie Sagal, let's listen to a scene from season 3 of Sons of Anarchy. Here, Katie Sagal as Gemma travels to Belfast with her son and another member of her motorcycle club to find her young grandson, who's been kidnapped. They trace him to an adoption center run by Irish nuns. The nuns tell him the boy's been given to a family for adoption, but refuse to tell them who the family is. Gemma grabs a gun, then grabs a baby, and aims the gun at the baby.
Bring me that baby. The kid! What are you doing?
Mom.
You know the story of King Solomon, right, sister?
Yes.
If I was that mother, I'd rather have a half-dead kid than watch someone else raise my flesh and blood. You understand where I'm going with this? Now, you gotta have done some kind of research on those scab parents. So we both know that this anonymous thing is b***h. Now, you are gonna tell us where our grandson is, or I swear to God, I will cut this baby in half.
And what we're not seeing in that clip, because this is radio, is the horrified look on the face of Gemma's son and one of the other really hardened bikers who's in the room. Katie Sagal, welcome to Fresh Air.
I just have to mention in that clip, the most horrified look was on the baby. Because as we were shooting this, the actual take they ended up taking, it was, you know, the director's dream. But the baby completely flipped out and was crying, looking right at me. I mean, it was just horrific.
Well, it must have been a weird scene to shoot because the baby was real.
It was a very difficult scene to shoot. It really...
And you have babies. You really are a mother.
Yes, I have three babies. And it's been the challenge and the very difficult part of this character, which is that she does things in the name of loyalty that I relate to, but she goes to means, you know, she goes way beyond anything that I would do.
So what's the position as the wife or the old lady of the leader of the biker club? What power does she have, and in what way is she subservient to her old man?
Well, this is what I'll say before I answer that, is that the character of Gemma is probably the most, we've taken the most creative license with. Because if you try to find research on the women in this subculture, it's very hard to find it. It's a very misogynistic culture. And I say that with all due respect. Everybody kind of knows that. So there's not a lot written about the women. And so it's a little bit of a different dynamic than other crime organizations where, you know, I can just relate it to The Sopranos, where those women sort of knew what was going on, but just turned a blind eye, basically, and lived nicely and didn't really get involved. Gemma tends to know everything. She knows what's going on. She's definitely... In this world, she's sort of the woman behind the man. You know, and this is kind of what my husband, who writes the show, has developed her to be. She is not based on any real person in that world. But she's the queen of the organization. So the guys in the club are very respectful of her. She's sort of like their surrogate mother in a way. And, you know, I think she pulls a lot of the strings behind the scenes. And she is privy to all the goings on.
And not so much anymore. Now that
no,
yes, now that she and her second husband are separated and basically trying occasionally to murder each other, more or less.
Well,
and her son is starting to pull away from her too because he realizes what trouble she's creating for everybody. So your character is losing her power and kind of, you know, smoking and drinking more.
Yeah, it's a long, sad road for Gemma right now. It's an interesting thing to play because what happened, you know, her dream come true happened at the end of last season where her son became president of the club. She's really all about her kid. You know, that's the most important thing to her and her grandkids. So she gets her dream, her wish come true. But in the meanwhile, she's estranged from her husband because of his horrible behavior. So what happens to the mother-in-law? Here she is sitting on the outside. So what happens to her? And, you know, what we see in this season is that she really falls apart because the club is all she knows. That is her world. Her backstory is that she left her family of origin and this became her only family. So it's been interesting to play this year, her lost journey. She'll come back, though, I promise.
I knew you from comedy before seeing Sons of Anarchy. And did you have to learn not only how to play this really tough character, but how to do things like slug people?
I did have to learn how to slug people. That doesn't come naturally. And, you know, when you're seeing a punch, there's a camera shooting from behind you so that you're not following through with the punch. You're just seeing the illusion of the punch. And, you know, you just imagine yourself. I'm sure we've all imagined ourselves taking a good wallop at someone.
So your husband, Kurt Sutter, created Sons of Anarchy. He was also a writer and an executive producer on The Shield. Did he write the part of Gemma with you in mind?
He did. So he came to me as he was writing and he said, I think I have a part for you. But he didn't really tell me what it was. And I didn't really know what it was until I actually read the script. And then, you know, we were sort of hoping the network would sign off on that.
It's interesting to think of him making the mother of his child such a really kind of crazy mother in the series.
Yes. You know, when he came into my life, I already had two children. And I was very protective of my children. And I think for him, he hadn't been around that kind of energy quite so much. So I think that's what was the springboard for Gemma. It was not so much the heinous things she does. It was that at her core, her motivation is these children, is her child, is to, you know, at any cost, she will protect him and her club.
I'd like you to describe your character Gemma's look on Sons of Anarchy. And I'm curious if you've ever worn clothes like that on stage, because you've sung, you know, you're also a singer, you've done a lot of rock shows, and I could easily see you dressing kind of like her when performing.
Yeah. I never actually did dress like her when performing, but absolutely, she has a rock and roll thing about her. My idea for Gemma was I wanted to have those blonde streaks in her hair, which looked very much like a stripper on a motorcycle to me. She's all about the leather. She's got a lot of tattoos. She has those streaks in her hair. It's really fun, I'll tell you, to walk around dressed like that.
Because?
It's sort of empowering. I think it's the shoes. I'm not sure. But, you know, I don't wear those big high heels in my life. But when you wear them, you just feel very tall and powerful. You just do. And it helps the character to be in all that.
It's funny that you should mention the high heels because in the TV series that made you famous, Married with Children, mm-hmm. you played Peg Bundy, you know, a wife and mother who doesn't really like to do housework or take care of the kids or do much of anything except shop.
Right.
And she's always kind of teetering around on high heels, taking these little mincing steps.
Right.
She almost looks like a dog walking on two paws with the other two paws held up because she has her hands kind of held up like that.
Yeah.
So it's two really different versions of walking around in high heels.
But her wardrobe was equally as important.
And it was. Describe it.
Yes. Well, when that character was shown to me, she was written to be very sloppy. She was supposed to be like this woman who never took care of herself and kind of was a couch potato. And I read the script and my take on it was I thought there needed to be some sort of sexual energy between her and Al Bundy because how could you talk to each other so horribly if something didn't happen that was wonderful also, even though he always was bemoaning that element of their relationship. So it was sort of my idea to doll her up. I thought, you know, she should look sexy, probably my own vanity involved there too. I didn't want to play such a sloppy character, but, you know, she should look sexy. She should be, you know, kind of those kind of shoes make you walk a certain way. So that was really sort of my input to the writing, which I ultimately think made it a little more real and not quite so difficult to take because, you know, they were pretty tough on each other, those two.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Katie Sagal. She stars in Sons of Anarchy, and a lot of people know her best from Married with Children. Let's hear a scene from Married with Children. And this is a scene. It's your birthday, and you're at home sitting on the couch with your husband, Al, who's played by Ed O'Neill.
Hi, Peg. How you doing?
How am I doing? It's my birthday, and you have the audacity to ask me how I'm doing? The best years of my life are over. And the worst part is, I spent them with you. By the way, Al, am I still attractive?
Peg, you're still the same knee in the groin you were when you were 16.
I don't believe you. You didn't say it with feeling. You're an insensitive hog of a man. Oh, I gotta do something to shake these birthday blues. I know. Give me money. I'm going to shop till you drop. Oh, by the way, Al, this does not get you off the hook for a present. And this year, I want something different.
Well, Peg, I only know how to do it one way.
And one day, maybe you'll get it right. No, honey. This year, I want something that lasts longer than 3 minutes.
That's my guest, Katie Sagal, with Ed O'Neill in a scene from Married with Children. So I'm just not sure where to start with that scene. So let's start with the laughter. Okay. Was that shot before a live audience, and was the laughter sweetened?
It was always before a live audience. We had very rowdy audiences. My guess is they didn't sweeten it because they had enough, but maybe they moved it around. I'm not quite sure the process. But we had uproarious laughter in our audience when we did that show.
So in that little clip that we heard, there were at least two sex jokes without using sex words in them. And I remember Married with Children kind of got into trouble with media, you know, conservative media watchdog groups because of the sexual allusions in it. Mm-hmm. What are some of your memories of that?
Well, it was really an issue of censorship. And at the time, we were very irreverent. And there was a woman named Terry Ricolta. And I will never forget because we sent her flowers every year. Because this woman tried to get us pulled off the air because she didn't want her kids to watch it. And our response was, well, you change the channel or you don't, you know, you put your kid in the other room. Or, you know, it wasn't about stopping it. It was about you should be the parent and monitor your child. But she caused such a ruckus and tried to get sponsors to leave the show that really what she did was like double and triple our ratings. And we ended up on the cover of the New York Times. It was really, I think it was after our third season where we were a hit, but we were still on the new Fox network that most people didn't have. I think like 60% of the country had it at the time. You had to have like little rabbit ears on your TV to get it. And she did exactly the opposite of what she had intended to do. So we did. We sent her flowers every year, which I'm sure really pissed her off. But, you know, Married with Children was racy. It was sexist. It was a lot of things. It was, but mostly it was funny. It was funny. And I think it had a place.
Let's talk a little bit about your singing career that preceded part of your acting career in which you became well-known. You might have already been acting when you were singing, but why don't we start by hearing you sing?
And, oh, sure.
Okay, so this is Son of a Preacher Man, and your version of this song, a song made famous both by Dusty Springfield and Aretha Franklin, your version of this was used in the first season of Sons of Anarchy. You want to explain what was going on as this played?
I don't remember.
Thank you.
You'd have to tell me. I don't remember which episode it's in. I sing a song every season, and they put it in different episodes. So I'm not sure which what was going on. And then it's all on the Sons of Anarchy soundtrack, which does pretty well on iTunes. I just recorded something for season 5 that will be in the finale.
Oh, can you tell us what the song is?
I wonder if I can. My husband has us all sworn to secrecy.
Yeah, I won't.
Every turn.
I don't want to ruin your marriage.
I don't think I can.
I don't want that crime in my book. Okay,
no, so I hear you.
So this is Son of a Preacher Man, and sung by my guest Katie Segal on a soundtrack of Sons of Anarchy.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son. When his daddy would visit, he'd come along. When they gather around the parlor talking, that's when Billy would take me walking. Through a backyard we'd go walking. Then he'd look into my eyes. Lord knows to my surprise that the only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what?
Katie Segal singing, who plays Gemma on Sons of Anarchy and is also known from her starring role on Married with Children. When did you start singing?
I've been singing since I was a very small child, for real. And my mother taught me how to play the folk guitar when I was probably 7, 8. And she had this old folk guitar that Burl Ives had given her. My mother had been a singer in the USO shows. She had a radio show when she was a kid. And so she taught me folk music. And it was really, as a kid, it was sort of my way into a social life. I was sort of very shy and kept to myself. But I was able to sing. And I had a pretty big voice. And so I started then, and when I was about 13 years old, I started writing music. You know, I was listening to Ella Fitzgerald and Lauren Nero and Joni Mitchell and the Rolling Stones, just a whole different, you know, everywhere kind of music. And that was really what I wanted to do when I grew up, was to be a singer-songwriter. And it's still, you know, to this day, it's still more the heart part of me, I would say. Like, I love to play music.
So for a while in the 80s, you were a harlot, one of Bette Midler's backup singers.
Yes.
So here's what I'm wondering. Can you sing just the harmony part of one of her songs?
You know, I don't know if I could. I could probably do the dance moves if I, you know, kicked up my heels in here. That was like the hardest job I've ever had in my, even to this day, I would say.
Why?
You know, Bette Midler. Well, she's fantastic, and she has a work ethic like nobody's business. So, well, first of all, it was the combination of having to sing these very intense harmony parts, you know, charted parts. There was a lot of 40s kind of Andrew Sisters music. And at that time, when I was a harlot, you were more a singer than a dancer. I've seen her show recently, and the harlots are more dancers than singers. So what she would do is I got the gig as a singer. And then I had to dance, like in high heels and in a mermaid fin and all these kind of crazy things that I just never thought I would be able to do it. And then she rehearsed. She would rehearse all the time. I mean, she was so diligent about performance. And, you know, she wouldn't just make us rehearse. She would rehearse, too. So it was like I never really went to... I dropped out of college, so she was like a college education for me. Between her and Etta James, who I also sang with for a year or so, it was really, you know, they were both just so meticulous in their own ways about what they were doing. So, but the Bette job, she was a taskmaster, I would say.
So I read that you also sang backup for Dylan, but that he fired you.
Yes, he fired me, and I would. But I always put it on my resume because it's so interesting to me. I was 19 years old, I think, and my friend used to hang out at his house, and she said to me, he needs background singers, and we sang together. So she brought me down to the rehearsal, me and this other girl, and Bob hired us on the spot. And he hired us without even really hearing us. I mean, it was really sort of weird. So we would have these rehearsals with Bob Dylan, and I worked with him for a couple of months, and then right before the tour, he fired all three background singers and half the band. But it was such a... You know, it was just amazing to stand in the room and sing Just Like a Woman with Bob Dylan. It was really amazing and kind of scary.
Did you know why he fired everybody or half of everybody?
In hindsight, I'm sure I was doing a terrible job. I think I was so intimidated to really speak or say anything. I think that I was in the wrong register in my voice, and I think he just wanted something different.
And one other background singer question, you did backup for Gene Simmons on a solo album of his in the 70s. Was he nicer to you than he was to me?
Was he mean to you?
Oh, he was very obnoxious to me when he was on the show.
Oh, that's a drag.
It made for interesting listening.
Gene Simmons got me my first record deal.
Really?
On Casablanca Records. And he was always a big supporter of me.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and that's how I sort of got onto his solo record, is we had sort of a personal connection for a minute. But basically, it was this weird set of circumstances where I met him, and it turns out the band I was in at the time, there was a guy in it that he'd gone to college with. So he came to the rehearsal, and before I knew it, we were in Neil Bogart's office on Casablanca.
The head of
Records,
Casablanca, yeah.
Correct, yeah, and we got a deal. That's when Donna Summer was there and Kiss had just been there and just started there. So it was Gene was very important in my work world.
Oh, nice to hear
I'm
that.
Sorry he was mean to you.
It's really fine. We got a lot of mileage out of it, believe me.
Not totally shocked. But
you grew up in an entertainment business family. Your mother was, I believe, a writer and director?
A writer and a director and a singer.
And
yes.
A singer. And your father was a director?
Yes.
I IMDb'd your father, and I couldn't believe what I found there. He like directed like every every TV show in like the late 50s and early 60s, like M Squad, Johnny Staccato, Mr. Lucky, Playhouse 90, Peter Gunn, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Dr. Kildare, Mr. Novak. That's just like the bottom part of his IMDb part. It goes on and on. But, you know, and I don't know how many episodes of these shows that he did, but these were really important programs. Did you grow up with shows that he directed?
Yes, I grew up watching Dr. Kildare, Man from U.N.C.L.E. I didn't see him that much from that IMDb, you'll see. You know, those were the days, you know, episodic television directing is a very long and arduous job. And, you know, you have very short schedules, you know, short shooting days, and you have to get a lot of pages done. So my dad worked really, really hard. So I say that only to couch it in. A lot of people think the showbiz family thing is very glamorous. I would say it wasn't. You know, it was very, it was wonderful. You know, my parents were very artistic and, but busy, you know, the times that I remember really seeing my dad and understanding my dad was when he would finally start bringing me to work with him. And then I was around that set environment and I'd sort of see what was going on. Because it's hard to describe to a kid what your job is. You know, it's hard to describe to anybody what that is, you know, and unless you actually see it. Here's the funny story. My dad was a Russian immigrant. And my grandmother, to the day she passed on, she never understood what he did for a living. And, you know, there was just no describing or explaining being in the television business. Of course, she didn't speak English very well either.
Being on the set with him when he was directing TV shows, was that fun? Did it seem magical or did it seem like work?
It got pretty much like, ugh, work after pretty quickly. I'll remember, though, I wasn't, like I said before, I was kind of a shy kid. And the minute I told my fifth grade friends that I could get, you know, girls, that I could get them on the set to meet Richard Chamberlain,
Dr. Kildare,
I was, you know, suddenly like the belle of the ball at the fifth grade, in the fifth grade. So it definitely served its purpose. I saw the intoxicating effect show business can have on people. I saw that early on.
Did it have that intoxicating effect on you, even though your father was directing the shows?
You know, actually not. I was not that impressed. And, you know, like I said before, too, I really wanted to be a musician. I had no aspiration at that point to be an actor. Part of me, I think, was rebelling against my father because he used to say to me, you know, you could be an actor. And he said it to me when I was young. And I thought, no, I want to be a singer. And so I didn't really... It didn't look glamorous to me at all, even when I met Elvis Presley, because, you know, my dad directed an Elvis movie.
Oh, which one?
And he directed a movie called Girl Happy with Elvis and Shelley Fabre. But I'll never forget, you know, he brought me to the set. I met Elvis Presley. I was so not impressed. Now I would be.
Wow.
I was like a snotty little 12-year-old, you know. I was just sort of, you know, whatever.
Huh.
Not my deal.
So your father was killed on the set of a made-for-TV movie that he was directing called World War III. And I think he accidentally was killed by a helicopter blade. Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he walked into the blade.
Do you know what happened?
Several things happened. Really what happened was he left his script in the helicopter. And they were shooting second unit. He was high altitude. Knowing my dad, he probably was in some sort of agitated, didn't get my shot stage. You know, he just was, you know, he's very involved with his work. We have since, you know, there was a safety regulation that we have since added to these helicopters. We had a big lawsuit with a helicopter company because it used to be you could get out of the helicopter before the blades had shut off. So he literally got out and lost his balance, went back to get his script, and that was, you know, he walked into a blade. And pretty much passed, you know, was definitely passed out and was passed on very soon after that, as soon as they got him off the mountain.
Well, just taking the knowledge of how something really tragic can happen on a set,
mm-hmm.
has it affected how you deal with things when you're on the set and you're assured, no, it'll be fine?
Well, I'm super cautious. I mean, the things that go on Sons of Anarchy, a lot of the physical stuff doesn't really involve me. I mean, there's a lot of motorcycle stunts and all kinds of potentially dangerous things that go on there. And, you know, luckily we haven't had any horrific events, you know, from all that. And, you know, working on a set with a lot of action, they take enormous precautions. You know, there's just enormous precautions. You know, anytime you fire a gun on a set, there's, you know, five people showing you that it's blanks. There's hollering to the crew, fire in the hole so that everybody knows that a gun is going to be shot. There's just constant vigilance around that. So, I mean, for me personally, I tend to be kind of a scaredy cat. You know, I don't like heights. I'm not as bold as Gemma, for sure. So I don't know if that's colored by what happened to my father. But I think what has colored me by what happened to my father, and my mother also died when I was young, is I have an early sense of mortality, which ultimately leads me to great appreciation for what I have right now. Because I am well aware that this is not a journey that is without an ending. You know, I know that it's finite. And I knew it young. I knew it when I was very young. So I think there's a different experience when you have that. When you lose your parents young, I think that you just have a different view of the world and a different perception.
Katie Segal speaking with Terry Gross. You'll find a longer version of their conversation online at freshair.npr.org. After the break, Sherry Turkle. Her book, Alone Together, is about how digital devices have changed the way we relate to each other. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Let's get to Terry's interview with psychologist Sherry Turkle. Turkle's been researching computer culture for 30 years. Her latest book, Alone Together, is about recent developments in digital culture with a focus on the young.
Sherry Turkle, welcome to Fresh Air. One of the things you write about in Alone Together is how children have grown up in a culture of distraction. Now,
yes,
I assume that there that you would be talking about how children and teens are so distracted by texting their friends all the time. But you're talking about children's parents, too, that children's
yes.
parents are distracted. I want you to describe some of the complaints that children have expressed to you about their parents being distracted by their personal devices.
Yeah, well, what my field work has shown is that children, from the minute these children met this technology, it was the competition. I do my field work in playgrounds, and parents are texting and on cell phones as their kids play on the jungle gyms and the swings, and parents text during breakfast and dinner as their children beg them for attention. Parents text at games when the kids are on the playing field, often missing the big score. So children grow up learning that they're not the center of their parents' attention. One of the most poignant interviews I did was with a young man who talked about how his father used to watch the Sunday games with him and maybe have the Sunday newspaper between them and share the sports section or the news section. And now his father does his email and texts, and it's just not the same. He misses his dad.
So let's turn the tables. What are some of the complaints parents shared with you about their children being distracted by their cell phones and other devices?
Well, parents then suffer the slings and arrows of not having their children's attention. I think that what's the big change I see now is that parents are starting to accept, really over the past 2 years, a little bit of the responsibility for that. It's hard to get your child's attention because your child doesn't want, for example, to answer your calls. Your child will only respond to a text message. Children during dinner will want to text. It's very hard to get them to come to dinner and eat. And so I suggest to parents that they use dinners as really sacred spaces where they say, look, dinner is a time when we come together as a family. And if I haven't followed these rules since you were young, I'm sorry. I've made mistakes too, but now we're starting to put a basket, you know, in the kitchen and in the dining room, and we all put our phones in that basket, and and the phones are turned off.
Uh-huh.
Just as a lot of professors are starting to say, you know, look, we've taken things too far, and we put a basket in the classroom, and this seminar really is for us having a conversation together, because I'm starting to. Because I taught a course last semester, and halfway through the course, it was a course on memoir, and a course in which the students in the course were sharing very, really intimate details of their life. It's a course where students talk about their lives. We read memoirs, and then the students write memoirs. And members of the class admitted that they were texting kind of under the desks, and we talked about it in class, and it was not okay that there was texting during class.
And your objection to that was that people were sharing intimate moments and other people weren't paying attention? Or were you afraid somebody was like live tweeting somebody's personal confessions?
No. The objection of the class was that this was really a conversation, and that we were losing the sense of this class as a conversation. And that is the value of what we're there to do together, is to have a conversation together. And that is what we should be about. And what the students taught, we had a great conversation about what was so seductive about texting. And essentially I heard from the students what I hear from so many adults. I think we've overhyped the difference between young people and older people on this issue. And they all say to me that what's so seductive about texting, about keeping that phone on, about that little red light on the BlackBerry is you want to know who wants you.
You had said before a lot of parents complain that their children will accept the parent's text message and respond to that, but they won't pick up the phone. They won't answer the cell phone. I'm sure you've spoken to children and teenagers about that. What's the explanation?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm working now on sort of this flight from conversation project because really what I'm hearing is people saying to me, I mean, this kind of phone phobia and also conversation phobia. And when I say to people, what's wrong with conversation? They say, I'll tell you what's wrong with conversation. You can't control what you're going to say, and you don't know how long it's going to take or where it could go. And that's exactly what's wrong with conversation, but that's exactly what's right with conversation. And this is the kind of thing that people feel they don't have time for in the incredibly busy lives and stressed lives that they have. And it's what people are getting used to not wanting to make space for emotionally. You know, it's the difference between apologizing and typing I'm sorry and hitting send. So I think we're substituting connection for conversation. And developmentally, adolescents would kind of rather do that, but developmentally, they're also missing out when they do that. So we're shortchanging ourselves, and I fear that we're forgetting the difference.
You write about how parents nowadays give their children a cell phone somewhere around the age of 9 or by 13, and the parents tell them, this is going to help keep you safe, because if you get in trouble, if anything goes wrong, you're a phone call away from your parent. What are the pros and cons, as far as you're concerned, of what you describe as the tethered child, the child who always has that connection?
You know, first of all, children, when I wrote the book, even in the brief time since I penned the book, the ages have kind of gone down to 8, to 7, to 6. Children are getting these phones early and earlier. These are years when children need to develop this capacity for solitude, this capacity to feel complete playing alone. Because, you know, if you don't have a capacity for solitude, you will always be lonely. And I talk to college students who've grown up, you know, with the habit of being in touch with their parents, you know, 5, 10, 15 times a day. And, you know, it's no longer Huckleberry Finn as a model of adolescence, kind of, you know, sailing down the Mississippi alone. We've developed a model of adolescence and childhood where, you know, we sail down the Mississippi together with our families in tow. And,
but that's very reassuring to parents, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, getting all those texts.
Parental reassurance is not the goal. The goal is a child who has a healthy separation and a sense of healthy separated identity. And we have to balance parental reassurance with a child who feels competent, independent, and able to be alone.
Some of the teenagers you were interviewing said to you that shouldn't they have a privacy zone, a right to a time when they don't have to take their parents' phone call, a right when they could just, like, not respond, just, like, be on their own and not respond. Would you describe the kind of concerns teenagers were expressing to you about that?
Yes. I mean, they basically felt that the technology was getting in their way of having what they, some of them would call it sort of teenagers had in yesteryear. Their older brothers and sisters were allowed to not be in touch with parents in a way that they felt was not available to them. But also, and this was very moving, they felt that on Facebook, their life story followed them through their lives. And one said to me, my God, it used to be that when you went away to college, you got a chance to start fresh, to be a new person. And that used to, I bet that was great.
I hear parents of young children you know, by young, I mean, say, you know, 9 to 14, 15, complaining that their children are, you know, insulted or attacked online. And that kids can be very brutal toward each other and very unthinking in what they say about each other. It's even easier to be that way when you're not making direct contact. How much have you looked into that, the kind of online bullying that so many kids experience?
I've looked into this a great deal. And it's not just kids. And it all stems from the same thing, which is that when we are face-to-face, we are inhibited by the presence of the other. We are inhibited from aggression by the presence of another face, the another person. We're aware that we're with a human being. On the internet, we are disinhibited from taking into full account that we are in the presence of another human being.
You know what this reminds me of just in my own life,
yeah.
You know, as an adult and a professional? I've had people walk out on me during interviews. It's always mm-hmm. been a long distance in interview when I'm in the studio in Philadelphia and they're in
yeah.
New York or California or, you know,
yeah.
LA, you know, Chicago, whatever. I've never had somebody be really rude to me or walk out on me when we were sitting face to face.
Absolutely. I just recently interviewed someone who gave me the most concrete and mundane example of this, which didn't involve bullying. He was talking about, as a child, wanting to get out of dinner. So this wasn't bullying. So it was, I think it makes it a better example, wanting to get out of dinner with his grandmother. And his mother used to say, call her. And so he had to call her. And he had to hear her voice saying, but honey, your grandfather and I have just set the table. The chicken is in the oven. The asparagus are all ready. We're waiting for you. We want to hear about the class you're taking. Oh, we're so sorry. We miss you. He could hear, even on the phone, not face to face, the voice, the disappointment. He was over there in a flash, as opposed to sitting down, typing or texting, I'm not coming over, and hitting send. It's all the difference in the world, and that's only the voice. Can you imagine having to go over to your grandmother's house and saying, I'm not coming over for dinner, I'm too busy?
You've been studying how the internet is affecting our relationships and sense of identity for a long time. So you've seen basically like a generation or two grow up mm-hmm. with this. So you've talked to people who use, I know, all of the personal devices now but didn't grow up with them. And you've talked to a lot of people who grew up with them and don't know any other world but the world of personal devices, of texting and cell phones and email and all these other applications. So what would you say are some of the major generational differences you've seen in how people respond to their devices and to other people?
Well, the most surprising thing for me is the similarities rather than the differences. Of course there are differences. You know, the sleeping with your cell phone is something that young people do. Very few young people don't sleep with their cell phones. They don't even pretend that it's an alarm clock. I mean, they don't. Older people sleep with their cell phones and they, you know, will pretend in an interview. I always ask, do you sleep with your cell phones? And older people say, yes, I use it as an alarm clock. Young people just admit that they sleep with their cell phones and they check their email, they check their texts many times during the night. Older people will go through the, will at least tell you that they use it as an alarm clock. That's one kind of difference in how the interview unfolds. But one of the things that I've got to say really has surprised me is how the hype about generational difference, I think, is greater than the difference themselves. I think the pull of these devices is so strong that we've become used to them faster than anyone would have suspected. I came to this interview without my phone. And when I got to the studio, I realized I'd left it behind. And I felt a moment of, oh my God, I left my cell phone behind. And I had to stop myself and think, I'm here. I really don't have anyone I need to call.
Our time is up. And before I say goodbye, I was just wondering, since you explained that you forgot your cell phone today and your first reaction was kind of panic. So when this interview is over, what's next? Do you go to wherever you were supposed to be headed, or do you go back home first and get your cell phone before doing anything else?
Well, I'm sort of intrigued by a cell phone free day. You know, I mean, I laughed at myself. I laughed at that moment of panic. I mean, I think there's good to recognize there, but for the grace of God, go I, kind of feeling. I mean, I'm not immune from the phenomenon I describe. It was a very interesting moment.
But aren't you asking yourself, say something, say your daughter really needs to get in touch with you, or say one of your students really needs to get in touch with you, or say you really need to get in touch with somebody?
Well, you know, I think we have really whipped ourselves up into a state where we live in a sense of emergency that is perhaps inappropriate.
You bring up in your book, like in the back of a lot of people's mm-hmm. minds, is like, what if a 9/11 attack happens and I don't have my cell phone?
Right. Well, actually, I think that 9/11 is a very important actor in this story. Because I've interviewed so many people who they talk about the emergency of what would happen. What would happen? They won't go to the candy store. They won't go to the convenience store without their cell phone, even when they have their children with them. And they talk. And when I interview them about why that is, their thoughts go back to 9/11. And I think that the 9/11 culture has. The convergence of the cell phone, this technology, with the 9/11 culture is a very, very important part of our story and of the story of this technology. And, you know, I mean, I think there comes a point where, you know, are we going to live every day of our lives on high alert? And I guess I'm willing to live today not on high alert.
Good luck with that.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Sherry Turkle speaking with Terry Gross. Turkle is the founder of MIT's Initiative on Technology and Self and is a clinical psychologist. Her latest book, Alone Together, forms a trilogy with her earlier books, The Second Self and Life on the Screen. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Saman, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.